Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Philip Weiss of the Middle East news site Mondo Weiss, who discusses how President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital will impact people across the Middle East and further damage already frozen Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. Jefferson Morley, Washington correspondent with Alternet, who explains why he believes the Trump White House consideration of a plan to set up a private intelligence network is both undemocratic and dangerous. And April Taylor, a sustainability scientist with the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma, who talks about how indigenous communities are building capacity to confront the impact of climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On the eve of a pivotal international conference on migration in Mexico, the Trump administration pulled out of talks on the United Nations Compact on Migration. The UN is negotiating a new framework to address the plight of refugees and find solutions to the large number of job seekers migrating out of the developing world. The Global Compact was launched by the UN General Assembly in September 2016, which approved the New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants. The declaration sought to enhance international coordination on migration. A compact on migration is a top priority for new UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley, in announcing the Trump withdrawal from the compact, declared, "Our decisions on immigration policies must be made by Americans and Americans alone. We will best decide how to control our own borders." In response to Trump's pulling out of the compact, journalist Karsten von Naumann wrote a column for Germany's public broadcaster Deutsche Welle stating that agreements made by the United States are no longer worth the paper they're written on. He warned that the president risks isolating the U.S. for the sake of his own fans and his own ego. Violence escalated in Yemen's three-year brutal civil war as the Iran-backed Houthi rebels killed former President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Saleh had switched sides in the war and recently allied himself with Saudi Arabia. Earlier, the former president had joined forces with the Houthi that controlled most of Yemen. Saleh was president of Yemen for over 30 years and was forced out of power during the Arab Spring. In recent days, Houthi rebels had openly clashed with Saleh's fighters for control over Yemen's capital and largest city, Sana'a. After Saleh's death, Houthis maintained control over Sana'a despite increased Saudi-led airstrikes. Yemen, the poorest nation in the Middle East, is now in the midst of a humanitarian crisis with over 8 million people on the brink of starvation and dangerous outbreaks of cholera. The situation has been triggered in part by a Saudi blockade of food and humanitarian aid. Thus far, over 10,000 civilians have been killed during the nation's three-year civil war. Although Washington has supported the Saudi air campaign against the Houthi rebels with weapons and refueling for its fighter jets, the White House has begun pushing for more access to humanitarian aid and has warned Riyadh that concern in Congress over the humanitarian crisis in Yemen could constrain future U.S. assistance. Texas populist Jim Hightower and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders' political organization, Our Revolution, ran a barnstorming tour through Texas to boost prospects for progressive victories in the 2018 election. Tyler, Texas, a blue-collar city, used to support Democrats like Hightower in the 1980s and 90s, before the town started to lose thousands of good-paying factory jobs at Goodyear and Carrier Corporation. In 2015, Tyler and its suburbs voted for Trump over Hillary Clinton by a 3-to-1 margin. Across Texas, Democrats haven't won a statewide race since 1994 and continue to lose congressional seats. Now, inspired by recent Democratic victories in Virginia and New Jersey, Our Revolution is making a commitment to revive the state's populist tradition. The group has targeted three Texas congressional seats whose district Hillary Clinton won last year. Our Revolution organizers are offering a populist, pro-worker, tough-on-billionaires message that Texas Democrats used to embrace. The group is also employing a strategy to run in places where Democrats aren't supposed to have a chance, drawing in frustrated Democrats, independents, and members of the largest political group in the state, non-voters. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
On December 6th, U.S. President Donald Trump announced his recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, setting off protests in the Israeli-occupied Palestinian West Bank and in nations across the Middle East and around the world. Trump ordered the U.S. Embassy to be moved from its current location in Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in the coming years. The unilateral declaration on Jerusalem broke with 70 years of American foreign policy, which held that the final status of the disputed city should be determined by Israeli and Palestinian negotiators. Jerusalem, the home of revered Muslim, Jewish, and Christian holy sites, is viewed by Palestinians as the future capital of a Palestinian state. Although Trump and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu maintain that the U.S. Jerusalem Declaration is simply recognition of facts on the ground, people around the world expressed their opposition to the move with passionate protests. While leaders of the Palestinian Islamist group Hamas called for a new intifada or uprising, Saab Erekat, the Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization, declared that Trump had disqualified the U.S. from any role in future peace negotiations. Your reporter spoke with Philip Weiss, co-editor of the online Middle East news site MondoWeiss.net. Here he assesses how President Trump's Jerusalem declaration will impact people on the ground in the Middle East and its effect on the already frozen Middle East peace process.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu went to Europe, tried to sell all the European nations on following suit, saying that Israel's capital is Jerusalem, and they all said, no way. So far, Trump is pretty alone here, and he does break with the tradition that Bill Clinton and George Bush and Obama observed, which was we're keeping the embassy in Tel Aviv. In Bush and Clinton's case, they both ran on the promise to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and then wiser heads prevailed. In Trump's case, he has followed through on a campaign promise that he made to the Israel lobby group AIPAC. As disruptive as it is, it's not as if it doesn't reflect the reality, which is that Israel has devoured Jerusalem. It's been devouring Jerusalem since 1967, when to claim the eastern half of the city after this 1967 war, the world has regarded that as an occupation. The United Nations has repeatedly called it an occupation, and Trump's decision, it's a huge blow to the two-state solution, but he has blown away the hypocrisy of American presidents, American administrations insisting that we're not going to move our embassy there, but on the other hand, we're not going to do anything to stop Israel from devouring Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. And the damage to the two-state solution is what Israel and the Clinton administration has done, what the Bush administration has done, what the Obama administration has done. And Trump is, in a sense, sort of simply acknowledging the failures of the American government to do anything to stop the Israeli settlement project.
As you said, Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insist the U.S. move here in recognizing Jerusalem as the Israeli capital is just a recognition of facts on the ground. But they maintain that this move by Trump will not derail U.S. efforts to initiate a new round of peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. How much credibility does that statement have?
It has no credibility whatsoever for me. And in fact, I think that's one of the things that enrages most angering about this announcement, the claim that you can pursue a peace process when you have already ceded central issues in what is to be negotiated to one side. And that is what Trump did. That actually, of course, is what previous administrations have done. But when Netanyahu says that, when he says, hey, this in no way forecloses a two-state solution, all he's trying to do is to keep Israel from being delegitimized in the eyes of the world. Because Israel wants it both ways. It wants to control all the territory, and yet it wants to claim that it's working toward a two-state solution. And when one prop of that sort of delusion is removed, i.e., you're not working toward a two-state solution, then the world has to move on and say, hey, this is apartheid. There's a struggle for equal rights going on here. Israel controls all the land. And the last thing that Netanyahu wants is for such a sort of international South Africa delegitimization campaign to begin. So he has to say, no, we've got the two-state solution alive. It's alive and well. And in fact, his cohort in the United States, the Israel lobby, the right-wing Israel lobby, is saying, no, is two-state solution is still right on the table. And they do this even as they know that they're not going to make any effort to bring that about. Promises that were made in Oslo and in the Oslo process a quarter century ago have been demolished, and the Palestinians have only seen less and less sovereignty over those years.
With Trump's declaration on Jerusalem, what are the repercussions, in your view, for the United States and Israel in terms of political and diplomatic isolation, the violence that we've seen crop up in places like the occupied West Bank and other regional capitals? What's the blowback for Trump and Netanyahu?
One has to begin by saying that I'm sitting in an armchair in New York, and hopefully we would not suffer violence that's going to flow from this, but there will be violence flowing from this, and people will lose their lives. A lot of people will be hurt because of this decision. That being said, I think that the international diplomatic consequences of this are actually extremely positive for Palestinians. I don't think Palestinians have ever had as much prestige internationally as they do right now, because you see even mainstream American voices, journalists who have tended to side with Israel again and again and again, looking at this situation and recognizing the Palestinians are getting screwed. And European countries are clearly very angry about this. Federica Mogherini, the foreign secretary of the EU, made it clear that Netanyahu, we are not acknowledging this. None of the European states is going to move their embassy to Jerusalem. And there's a great deal of sympathy for Palestinians that I think will translate into some real moves on the Palestinian people's part. I don't know quite what entity that will be. It's the BDS campaign, the boycott campaign, has been fostered by this move. Whether the Palestine Liberation Organization will take its case now to the International Criminal Court, that might be one of the outcomes of this. The PA might collapse. But we are seeing an edifice of 25 years of lies of the Oslo process, in which the Palestinians have been deceived again and again and again, and in which the world has been told, no, they are not a partner to peace. That edifice is collapsing. And now we see that the Palestinians, they got screwed the other day in Washington, and it just lights up all the times that over the 25 years that they have been lied to. And so I think that there will be a lot of people coming to their side, countries coming to their side, international movements coming to their side, and that will be the good consequence of this decision.
That was Philip Weiss, co-editor of the online Middle East news site, MondoWeiss.net. Find more news and commentary on Trump's Jerusalem declaration by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Intercept and BuzzFeed recently reported that the Trump administration was considering a plan to establish a private, off-the-books intelligence network that would run counter-terrorist propaganda efforts around the world. The proposal was developed by Eric Prince, the founder of the Blackwater private security firm that had been found responsible for massacres of civilians while under contract to the Pentagon during the U.S. war in Iraq. Prince, the brother of Trump Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, had reportedly teamed up for the project with his former CIA colleague John McGuire, the company Emmentor Group, and Iran-Contra scandal figure Oliver North. According to The Intercept, the network would provide CIA Director Mike Pompeo in the White House with a global private spy network that would circumvent official U.S. intelligence agencies. Sources say the plans have been pitched to the White House as a means of countering deep state enemies in the intelligence community seeking to undermine Donald Trump's presidency. Your reporter spoke with Jefferson Morley, Washington correspondent with Alternet, whose recent article titled "The Last Thing America Needs is Trump Armed with His Own Private CIA," which examines the private spy network proposal. Here, Morley explains why he believes privatizing U.S. intelligence operations is both undemocratic and dangerous.
There have been these stories that have been circulating since the summer about Eric Prince looking for a way into U.S. policy and offering his services. The first form that the story took was an offer to help in Afghanistan, where Prince has an extensive network of contacts through his security company that was once known as Blackwater. The name has now been changed several times to escape the notoriety of Blackwater's actions in Iraq, where they were involved in several massacres, killing of non-combatants. So Eric Prince is trying to escape that past while drumming up new business with the government. His proposal for privatizing secret operations in Afghanistan was rejected by Defense Secretary James Mattis, but this story that came back and that was reported on by BuzzFeed and The Intercept and Alternet regarded a different proposal but a similar concept of offering private security companies services to the CIA. And the reports were that specifically that they were looking for, that they would provide help with rendition, right, which is a fancy way of saying they would assist the CIA in capturing, kidnapping people and bringing them to the United States to face some kind of justice. We've had episodes in the past where the CIA the president wants the capability to do something that the CIA says it can't or won't do. So it's not unprecedented, but the plans that are being proposed now are unprecedented. I mean, the idea that a private company would go and do a rendition of foreign terrorist suspects, that's never been heard of before. And one of the CIA people, retired CIA people who I talked to, said, you know, that's just a non-starter. You know, that the idea that you would have a Blackwater for rendition, it's kind of extraordinary. But you know, we live in extraordinary times, and you know, you'd think such a thing wouldn't be feasible, but you know, we've seen a lot of unfeasible things happen. So you know, I take it very seriously.
Jefferson, what was the initial response of the White House? And I note here that their first reaction was to declare some kind of fantasy and fake news, but later they hedged a bit and didn't quite dismiss it out of hand. Maybe you could review that for us.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the White House understands that these are very controversial ideas, you know, bypassing the CIA, creating an intelligence network that responds, you know, only to the president and is not publicly funded. I mean, there's a lot of alarm bells that are going to go off. So they're saying it's fake news, but they're not denying that this company, Amintor, run by a friend of Eric Prince, has indeed proposed these actions. So they haven't really denied the facts of it. They've just tried to discredit the message and say somehow that it's fake. But as far as we know, it's still under consideration, you know, but now that there's been a light shown on it, you know, they may be reluctant to go ahead, given that, you know, it may create political problems for them.
What's been the reaction, if any, that we know of from U.S. intelligence agencies, the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agencies, about this story of a private off-the-books intelligence outfit that Trump wants to report directly to him?
Well, there hasn't been any official reaction from the CIA, you know, and they're in a tough spot because the CIA has only one client. That's the president. So if the president says, I want to do things this way, the CIA is going to be loath to tell him no. So the institutional pressure within the CIA is going to be, you know, to go along with it. A CIA guy who I talked to, retired officer, distinguished, not part of the current CIA, you know, thought that the idea was crazy. Why would you have a CIA doing something, that the CIA didn't want to do, or couldn't do? His thought as an intelligence professional was that it was just a bad idea, quite apart from the politics, whatever political goals the Trump administration might be seeking. In the idea of running an intelligence service to create a private competitor, it's not the way to go. We have a CIA to accomplish certain tasks. To create another entity to do that, either you're trying to evade the law or you're trying to evade public accountability. But, whatever it is, it's not necessary and it's not a good idea. And we saw in Iran-Contra what the results were, massive lawbreaking.
That was Jefferson Morley, Washington correspondent with Alternet, whose recent article is titled, "The Last Thing America Needs is Trump Armed with His Own Private CIA." Morley's new book is titled, "The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton." Find links to more articles on Trump's private spy network proposal by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The theme of this year's annual American Public Health Association conference, held in Atlanta last month from November 4th through the 8th, was climate change and health. The keynote speaker was an indigenous woman from northern Alberta, Canada, who's helping to lead the fight against tar sands extraction. Several of the conference panel discussions dealt with indigenous community concerns regarding the changing climate and actions they're taking to confront these changes. For centuries, Native Americans have relied on natural resources to sustain their families, communities, traditional ways of life, and cultural identities. This relationship with both land and water makes indigenous people and cultures particularly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the American Public Health Association conference and spoke with April Taylor, a sustainability scientist with the Chickasaw Nation, who works at the South Central Climate Science Center in Norman, Oklahoma. In the following interview, Taylor describes her job assisting 68 tribes across New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana manage and plan for the many environmental impacts of climate change, including issues such as tribal water rights, sea level rise, flooding, droughts, and wildfires.
The way I explain my job is I do three things. One, I'm a matchmaker. So I am out engaged with tribal staff of various types, and I matchmake them with climate scientists and researchers to work together on projects and go after funding to plan for the impacts they're seeing in their communities already for climate change and what they might see in the future. The second aspect is we do trainings. We build tribal capacity. We've done 32 trainings in the last four and a half years. And they're on all sorts of things, including grant writing, data and tools, and how to find the right information and resources to developing the plans for their communities. And then the third aspect is we do youth outreach, so promoting Native students in STEM fields, creating our next generation of tribal staff.
You mentioned, I think, four states that you cover, and some of them I know have had huge climate impacts, including, what is being described as the first U.S. climate refugees, a small tribe in Louisiana.
I just wrote a piece for the National Climate Assessment on the Louisiana tribes. We've done quite a bit of trainings and networking down in Louisiana. It's really interesting to see them doing this relocation in their own way. They're moving their entire community. It's really cool to see that they want to do that, and it's sort of bringing them closer together. A lot of those communities, they've lived on the coast for a very long time and were forced out to those areas.
This is Ile de Saint-Charles, did I get that right?
Charles, yeah. Okay. But there are other communities out there as well. There's Pointe Aux Chênes. Chittimacca is out there as well. Chittimacca is really leading the way in the scientific aspect and mapping out their sea level rise and, and making their plans. Huma tribe is out there as well, the Huma Nation, and they're very active and aware of climate change. And we have the Kushada tribe. They're going to be impacted as well, even though they're very far up on the mainland right now. I work with more of the scientist or planners type people. It's not uncommon that we get, especially in those communities that are being impacted now, that you get leadership involved. Our last training was in May, and it's really interesting. I mean, you get community members, you get Native church people that come in for these trainings because they're interested. They want to know what's happening and what are they dealing with.
Is it mostly sea level rise and flooding? Are there other issues related to climate change that you're seeing in the tribes you work with?
Drought. Several of the tribes are doing drought planning. Wind River just finished theirs. Chickasaw Nation is waiting for the final approval to finish ours. And they're really leading the way and taking the leads before the states and before what's required. They're not required to do drought planning, but they're doing these things. Wildfires is another huge one. Loss of water resources and tribal water rights is a big one. So we're not seeing the stream flows or the snow melt. These communities are seeing these changes. We're seeing changes in species and how species are being in cultural significant species and how they're changing already. And so some of these species that they rely on, what's happening is what we call, and there's an indigenous phenology network. And phenology is basically the timing of the seasons and when things change. And so they're seeing some of those changes happening, you know, months earlier. And so they're trying to figure out if what that means for their culture, for the communities. Do we change the ceremony and things like that? For my tribe, we have a butterfly restoration project as well. So there are 7 tribes doing butterfly restoration, trying to help the species adapt.
That was April Taylor, a sustainability scientist with the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma. Learn more about how indigenous communities are building capacity to confront the issues of climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.